Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. 73% of the teachers in Pennsylvania schools are women, but only 28% of school superintendents are women. However, on average, the female superintendents have higher salaries than their male counterparts. These are a few of the findings of a series by the online media organization PA Post on school superintendents. The author of the series of stories is PA Post reporter Ed Mahan. Ed, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
If you have a question or a comment, some interesting information, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Ed, looking into salaries, employment, the breakdown in superintendents across Pennsylvania. How did this story, what was the genesis of this story?
So there's been a lot, I cover politics too, and there's been a lot of attention this past election on the fact that Pennsylvania previously had no women in it in Congress, and Pennsylvania sent no women to Congress. So I was curious about other areas too. So I looked at the superintendency. We have about 500 school districts in the state, so it seemed like a large sample size to look at the issue.
So generally, what did you find then?
So there's a lot less women who are leading school districts than men. And as you said, the women who do lead them do tend to earn a little more. But another important factor is that women are more likely to have a higher level of education. They're more likely to have a doctoral degree than their male counterparts. And that's big in education. I mean, a lot of times teacher union contracts, salary increases are based on education levels. So that's one of the big factors.
You know, that may raise some eyebrows because we've heard often that, you know, we know it's a statistic that is quoted fairly often that women make about 78 cents compared to the dollar that a man makes, not just here in Pennsylvania, but across the country. It's 77 to 78 cents. But in this profession, women are making more, but again, very important factor in that the women superintendents, on average, have more doctoral degrees.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons I was interested in looking at this too, because, you know, superintendents, unlike teachers, superintendents, they negotiate directly with the school board in terms of what their salary should be, and so I was curious if there was any discrepancy in what school boards would want to pay a woman superintendent or female superintendent. And we didn't find that necessarily. Another thing too, we looked at the sizes of the districts and we didn't find any significant differences in whether men or women were more likely to lead bigger or smaller school districts. And that has a big impact on salary too.
But in that introduction that I just read, 73% of teachers in Pennsylvania classrooms are women. Probably doesn't surprise a lot of people. I'm sure that there are school districts, schools that would like to get a lot more men in their classrooms as well. But 73% are women, but only 28% of superintendents are women. Why aren't women, in your research, why aren't women going from the classroom to the administrative part of this?
And yeah, so there's a couple factors, and according to some education experts who have looked at the issue, some of them suggest that there could be discrimination in terms of who school boards, who district leaders are willing to promote up the chain, essentially, like find who they're willing to peg as who they think is going to be leadership potential. Another factor, I talked to a Penn State professor, and he talked about, there's discrepancies at home in terms of who has to do more of the housework, childcare work, and there's research that often falls on the woman in a relationship as opposed to a man. And so because the superintendency is such a high demanding job in terms of hours and everything like that, the Penn State professor was saying it, unless the male partner is willing to pick up some of the work at home, then the woman is going to have difficulties pursuing it.
of course, that could hold true in any profession.
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, you hear that all the time, but again, in so many other careers and occupations, jobs, professions, that women who still have to deal with those same issues are still paid less than men. What about tenure and that kind of thing? Because, again, when you look for explanations in the disparity of pay between men and women, often some of the factors you just listed, that women who do tend to stay home with kids sometimes, do more of the housework and all that, yeah, don't build up the kind of time that a man would. What about in this profession?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I didn't look at the impact of... I think what I found was that the superintendents, the male and female superintendents, they tended to have the same level of experience in education, the same number of years of service. I mean, one factor, too, is the superintendent job is... You know, I talked to some superintendents about this and some people who want to be superintendents, is that there's a level of risk involved in that either you know, there's more security as a classroom teacher and more security as a principal. Once you become a superintendent, you're hired by a board that is, you know, they're elected, and you could, on the surface, there could be no problems, but they might want to go in a different direction after 5 years. So then they just, not because you did a bad job necessarily, but because they want a new direction, they will let you go, and then you either have to go move somewhere or look for a job, look for another similar position. So there's a career. It's not as certain, as guaranteed. You know, we talk about, you mentioned tenure. That's sort of like a classroom teacher. You know, if they do a good job or good enough job, they can have some security in terms of where they're, of that they can stay in that district for their career.
And most teachers are a member of a union, mm-hmm, that does provide more job security for them. But you're right. Probably the average, I don't know what the average teacher salary is in Pennsylvania, but what was the average superintendent salary?
So for female superintendents, we found the median was like $139,000, and for men it was like $2,000 less.
Mm-hmm. So probably a superintendent is... earning or is making maybe $60,000-$70,000 more a year than a classroom teacher.
Than some of the classroom teachers, for sure.
So there is some risk. But I wonder, you know, and you could say, again, this about many professions, that is money, salary, the main motivator? I mean, it would seem as though, because I know that you talk to by the way, Ed Series is on papost.org. You can read about it, and we have a link on our website, wytf.org. But, you know, there are some risk involved, as you just said, that you may have to move, that you have a board that you have to answer to, you have taxpayers that you have to answer to. But at the same time, some of the superintendents, the women that you talk to, what they had to think about, is this something I really want to get into with all the challenges that leading school districts, but all the challenges that schools are facing today? Because a teacher, let's face it, it's a stressful job. You have a lot of challenges, mm-hmm, but the superintendent has a wider array of challenges.
Yeah, I talked to Janet Serino. She's a superintendent in Luzerne County. She's the, I think there's that 10 or 11 school districts up there. She was the only female superintendent in the county. She talked about how she got into education because she wanted to work with children. She loved working with children. It was something she knew she always wanted to do. She worked at a small, she couldn't find a full-time job at a public school, ended up working at a parochial school. Moved on to become the principal there, got recruited to work in a school district. And she was a principal, and she liked being a principal. She liked having the more direct interactions with students, more direct interaction with parents. And her old boss, her old superintendent, he often would tell her that, I think you'd be good at this, being a superintendent. And she wasn't sure if she wanted the job. She liked what she was doing, and she was worried about her focus going too far from those areas. Because, yeah, superintendent, you're dealing with budgets and finance, and it's less of the, often less of the direct interaction. And one of the things she talked about is, you know, one thing was that she, you know, made it a point to still be engaged with the students, to still be engaged with the curriculum and how curriculum is developed. And to sort of, the way she feels about it is, you have to like be involved in every detail of an organization to really understand it. But the kind of work that you're doing is, you know, is different. It's a different kind of focus.
I remember part of a quote that you had in your story from her where she mentioned that school security was something that concerned her, whether it was something that she wanted to deal with as a superintendent.
Yeah, and her district, like a lot of districts, has had issues with that. They had a threat in a bathroom. Someone was threatening violence at the school. It led to a lockdown, a several hours long lockdown at the school, and then they added metal detectors after that. And there was a lot of community outcry over how everything was handled and whether it was handled the right way, and people were upset about what it meant.
I think the big question many people would have is, why does it matter?
So to the Penn State education professor, and the way he put it was that, one, there's the level where there's a question of like equality and whether everybody has the same opportunity to excel in the profession. But two, it's the question of whether you're actually going to get the best pool of candidates. And these are, important jobs. They're six-figure jobs. There's a lot riding on them. And whether districts are doing everything they can to make sure that they have the best people for those jobs.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that does come up in this story as well. Well, I don't know if you address this directly, but you heard about this as you're discussing, and I think about it all the time because I hear it on Smart Talk when we discuss about education funding, and taxpayers are often looking for places where there could be cuts, where there's too much money spent, and one of the things I hear most often on this show, one of the biggest criticisms, is that administrators make too much money. That if you would cut some of the salaries of administrators, that there wouldn't be school districts spending the kind of money they are. Is that something that came up in your reporting?
It's something we're interested in looking into as well. So we got this big database. You can search online, see every superintendent's salary in the state. And one of the things we did is we compared it with the population, so you can see how much each superintendent earns for every student in their district. And so some superintendents earn, a few dollars for every student in their district, while other superintendents earn over $100 for every student in their district. And that doesn't tell you everything about the challenges of those particular districts, but it's one way of gauging, making some comparisons between how they're actually compensated. And the other thing is we have like 500 school districts in the state, so there's been pushes over the years to reduce that, and the idea is that you would, eliminate some of, you'd have less of these superintendents that you'd have to pay these salaries to.
Did that come up in your conversations with some of the administrators?
I guess I didn't really. I mean, I was talking about their own experience about pursuing it. I didn't get into.
Yeah, I'd be curious as to whether they would. We talked about their challenges. Whether they would want to face the challenge of having to compete if there were fewer school districts compete for jobs.
Yeah, that's interesting. One of the things they did talk about was the challenge of the Janet Serino in Luzerne County talked about the funding challenges, and one thought she had is that the job, if all you're doing is cutting, that might be less appealing to some people.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. During this portion of the program, we're joined by PA Post reporter Ed Mahan, who is discussing his series of superintendents, about Pennsylvania school superintendents, that what they're paid, the number of female superintendents compared to male superintendents, a lot of data there if you'd like to go to papost.org. And again, you can link to it. I'd encourage you to read PA Post every day, subscribe to PA Post, but if you'd like to read this particular series, you can go to WITF.org, and today's Smart Talk article, we do have a link to that. If you have a question or a comment, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@WITF.org. On Facebook, you can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Ed, you were talking about Janet Serino, who is the superintendent at Wyoming Valley.
Wyoming area.
Oh, that's right. There's two different school districts up there, Wyoming Valley and Wyoming area.
I think so, yeah.
But she's a superintendent there in Luzerne County, and you said she's the only woman who is a superintendent. There are some areas in Pennsylvania, because you do have a map included in your series, there are some counties where there are no women superintendents at all.
Yeah, and so we broke it down, and you know, there's a lot of them. We broke it down into like three main areas. One is areas where they have no women superintendents, and you see a lot of those in like the central part of the state. And then there are some areas where they have more female superintendents than male superintendents, or at least an equal number. Dauphin County and Lebanon County are two of the counties that have either an equal or a greater number of women superintendents. But you know, and there are also, you know, I think one of the things I heard in the reporting sort of informally is that there are just, you know, some more rural areas of the state that are less likely to hire female superintendents. You know, we didn't do like a huge analysis of that, but I mean, if you look at some of the northern rural counties, some of them have more female than male superintendents. So I didn't find a huge rural versus urban, suburban breakdown.
Mm-hmm. How does Pennsylvania compare with the rest of the country?
So in this area, we actually have a higher percentage of female superintendents. We have about 28%. Nationally, it's about 23%.
Do we know why? That's always the big question.
I think the data I saw at the national level, I didn't see a breakdown of what states are more likely to have female or male superintendents. I mean, I think that would be helpful to know, to sort of like reach further conclusions.
Mm. Let's take a phone call from Heather in Mannheim. Heather, you're on the air.
Hi, I actually know a female superintendent, and both of my children had gone through that school. She actually started out as a principal and ended up being superintendent. She knew my kids' names. She was really, really awesome. What I find is, you know, people that knew her would call her this word or that word and be derogatory because she was firm but fair. She handled things. And I often find that people will skew their vision of somebody who is maybe in a more powerful just because they're female. And if you're aggressive and independent, you have a harder time, and maybe that's why we don't have enough female superintendents.
You know, Heather, what you're talking about, though, you can, that often is what you hear about women in leadership positions, is that a woman mm-hmm. who is assertive, that or you know, ambitious, or you know, they'll say, "Oh, well, she's pushy, she's bossy." But a man who has the same characteristics say, "Oh, that's leadership material right there."
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that it's more predominant because you have so many more female teachers than you do male teachers. So wouldn't you want it to be a higher percentage of female superintendents to kind of go along with the lines of how many female teachers you have?
Mm. Hey, Heather, thank you very much for your call.
And yeah, I mean, one of the reasons I was interested in this is in Pennsylvania, we've never elected a woman governor. We've never elected a woman to the U.S. Senate. And so those same kind of stereotypes or come up in that political arena, and the superintendency in some ways is a political arena. It's not you're not elected to the position, but you are serving at the pleasure of the board.
Heather mentioned, and you have too, about principals, and you have found that there aren't very many. I should ask you the question, because I'm not going to make a statement without knowing the background. But what does it come down to when you talk about women principals versus men principals?
So the one Penn State education researcher I talked to, he mentioned that issue, that the high school principal is typically a big stepping stone to the superintendent job, and that his research found that districts are less likely to hire women in the high school principal position. I didn't look at that specifically in Pennsylvania. The one thing I did find is that, so you have this big pool of women who are classroom teachers, about 73%. Then when you get to administrators, it's more even. It's like 50%. But then when you get to the superintendent position, it's about 28%. So I don't know exactly how many of those administrators are women or are high school principals, but it's more even when it comes to school administrators.
I think even, and again, this is just an observation, and I don't know this to be certain, so and I again, I don't know if you have this information, but it seems as though you'll find more women principals below the high school level, like in elementary school, maybe middle school.
Yeah, I mean, I used to cover K-12 education, you know, exclusively, and that did seem to be the tendency. I covered it in Center County, and it seemed like there were a lot more elementary school principals who were women. But then at the high school level, they're more likely to be men.
My first elementary school was at a woman who was the principal, and we were all afraid of her. Now, this is the 1960s. You got to remember. Yeah. Lyndon Hummelstown says, the issue of salaries in administrative positions misses the focus. Issues should be consolidating administrative duties to consolidate reporting requirements, not the teaching duties. And this gets back to what we're talking about with consolidation, that many people criticize and complain about the salaries administrators make. The point that Linda's making is there are too many of them. Something that you looked at?
I didn't look at the number of administrators at this point and comparing it to other times. I think where I've done reporting in the past is the question of consolidating entire districts, and that way the idea is you could consolidate some administration leaders. But I don't have more details.
Let's go to Ken in New Oxford. Ken, you're on the air.
Yes, I'd like to make a comment to the secretaries of the superintendents. Couldn't we say that this is a bias or stereotype that they happen to be all female?
You mean the administrative assistants, the secretaries?
Yes, right. Aren't they females?
I don't have data on that.
Just observation?
I don't have a great observation about this. But are you getting at something?
Yeah.
What I'm trying to say is that it seems to be there's a bias as far as the female-male, and predominantly secretary roles are just for a female.
Mm-hmm. And, one of the things, Jay...
you don't find many males as secretaries.
Mm-hmm. Hey, thank you for your call, Ken.
One of the things Janet Serino, I talked to her about, she was, one of her explanations for why there's more male superintendents was just that for a long time that was how things were. And when she was growing up, it seemed like, most of the opportunities were for to be secretaries or teachers or nurses. But as time has gone on, things have broadened out.
She actually said, though, and this is a quote in your story, is that she feels like she is treated differently.
Yeah, a little differently in some ways. And one of the examples she gave is that the handshake, and it's a simple thing, but she's noticed that people are sometimes hesitant to shake her hand, but they're much more comfortable just shaking the hand of a male colleague.
She
notices it.
You have to notice it. I mean, I've noticed that where there'll be a group of men and women, and maybe women... fewer women than men in a room, and the people walk in will shake the hands of the men first and maybe shake the hands of the women.
Yeah.
So, again, I think that's probably something that we as a society do, not just in this field. So are there some ideas out there to increase the number of women that are leading school districts?
Yeah, so I was looking at some research from the national there's a national organization for superintendents. They had a researcher there several years ago. He had some ideas about providing incentives for states to provide incentives to school districts, like grants to hire female or minority candidates, that they would like essentially pay the salary for the first year. He also suggested, the position if the question is whether women don't actually want. If women are less likely to want the job, if the issue is parts of the job, like he was saying that you can, if there are responsibilities that you can assign to certain areas, to have your administrators do. Mm-hmm. I guess when it comes to the issue of whether how much time you're spending on finances, how much time you're spending on curriculum, how much time you're spending on security, trusting the administrative team to pick up some of those areas too. So you can focus on more of the areas that you would want to.
But let me get back to it. I asked this question, but let's just bring it up again. Why does this matter?
And so I think the big question, the issue is, there's the issue of equality and whether everybody has the same opportunity. And there's a question of whether school districts are really getting the best people for the job.
Mm-hmm. Are there school districts that are looking at this and saying, we have say 55% females in our district, we probably, I mean, like you would a police department. Mm-hmm. Do they actually think that way?
I guess I didn't spend. I mean, I think there are areas of the state that are pushing for, you know, more inclusion. There's a women's caucus as part of the Association of School Administrators. They're focused on increasing opportunities for women in school districts. So there are people who are concerned about this issue.
Mm-hmm. So what do you hope that the people will take away from the series? What will they learn?
I guess it would provide some context for where their school. They probably know who their school district superintendent is. They have this series and the information we have online gives context for, where their compensation falls in line with the rest of the state, and if they notice they're in an area that doesn't have many or any female superintendents, they might realize they're not just unusual in that respect.
We have a phone call from John in Lancaster. John, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My wife and I both work in public education, and just an observation, having been married to an educator in Pennsylvania for 32 years and knowing many of her female friends, I would just comment that, my wife through the years has thought about maybe getting a principal certificate, but the reality is she's just so passionate about teaching. Mm-hmm. And it's her gift, and it's what she's passionate about. So the idea of administration just doesn't appeal to her, and I think a lot of her friends are that way as well. And then the ones that I do know that move up through principals and maybe superintendent positions, there's a real sacrifice, because a lot of these ladies, I think teachers work harder than just about anybody in the professional field. There's a lot of evening hours associated with principals and superintendents, and if they have families at home, a lot of these ladies are wonderful moms and wonderful teachers. They just can't find that balance once you move into administration. Just wanted to kind of share that insight.
All right. Thank you very much for your call. It kind of goes back to what you had said, that you have heard from some people as to some of the reasons that there are fewer women.
Yeah, and some of the challenges, too. I talked to the associate superintendent and associate superintendent in the Lehigh Valley, and she talked about just some of the, she wants to become a superintendent, but, being in administration, she talked about some of the challenges in terms of time and having to choose between, her son's soccer game or district events. And, yeah, she was actually pursuing a doctoral degree several years ago, but just without all the other demands, it wasn't something she could prioritize. Mm.
Reporter Ed Mahan, who is with PA Post, and you can see the series at papost.org. We have a link on WITF Smart Talk webpage. Ed, thank you very much for the hard work. There's a lot of good information, a lot of good data there.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, cap and trade through the courts in Pennsylvania. That's one of the issues. Yeah, you will hear something about it. You think about cap and trade and climate change and whether there are industries that should be paying more for how much in the way of emissions that they put into the atmosphere. That's something that we've heard about on a federal level, but maybe here on a state level, we'll hear more about it. That's coming up on tomorrow's program. The number of schools offering music education in Pennsylvania and the nation is in a steady decline and has been for more than a decade. Reduced budgets and shifting priorities are often to blame. Music for Everyone is a Lancaster-based nonprofit working to raise awareness and resources to strengthen the role that music plays in schools and the community in the face of declining music programs. Music for Everyone has provided over 6,000 instruments to Lancaster County schools since 2006. And there's a lot more going on there. Joining us is Dr. John Gurdy, who is founder and executive director of Music for Everyone. Dr. Gurdy, welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
Also joining us on the phone right now is Lisa Sempsey. She's a music teacher in the Columbia School District in Lancaster County. Ms. Sempsey, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. John Gurdy, before we get into the current situation across the country and across Pennsylvania and in Lancaster County of music programs and schools, I think that your background and how Music for Everyone was founded and developed says a whole lot. You were an athlete. I don't know if you still are or not, but
not so much.
But you were an All-America basketball player at Davidson College. You were the school's leading scorer until someone by the name of Steph Curry came along, played pro basketball for 3 years. So you would seem to be someone that would advocate strongly for athletics in schools, but yet music is your passion and helping schools to, I don't want to say maintain in some areas, but further expand their music programs in others. How did it all come to be?
Well, I mean, you talk about my passion really is education reform. It's preparing our children to compete in the global integrated world economy and world community of the future. So education is my passion. After playing basketball, I ended up working in college athletics at the NCAA and as associate commissioner of the Southeastern Conference. And I always did that because I viewed athletics as a tool to supplement the educational process if it's kept in the proper perspective. With the birth of our first child, I left the SEC and was a stay-at-home parent for our two children. And as the kids got older, they didn't need dad around as much anymore. And so I had this wonderful opportunity to reinvent myself. I could have gone back into college athletics, but, been there, done that. And as a lifelong musician, I started doing the research on how school music programs are being cut and defunded. And at the same time, all the research about how effective it is as an educational and community building tool. And it just didn't make sense to me. So, you know, trying to think on, act on the notion of think globally, act locally, I got some friends together, did a small fundraiser. We raised about $11,000 and bought some instruments for the School District of Lancaster. And then it just kind of, be careful what you ask for, it just kind of mushroomed. But to me, it's not much of a jump because similar to athletics, which is a tool to supplement the educational process if it's conducted in the right way, music is the same. It's a tool to contribute to the educational process. I've come to the realization or belief after being involved very heavily in both as an athlete or a musician or as an administrator in both ends, that music, if you do a thorough, honest, clear-eyed, data-driven return on educational investment in dollars spent on, for example, tackle football versus music programs, it's not even close. If you were keeping score like a football game, the score would be 55 for music and 20 for football. It's just that effective right on down the line. Everything from, the currency of the future is creativity, and a lot of the jobs our children are going to have in the future haven't even been invented yet. But music is the most effective tool in our educational arsenal to teach creativity.
But how do you measure that?
I think music, at its core, music is about creativity. It's about thinking out of the box. Arts are about being able to color outside the lines without penalty. But if you look at a number of other things as well, you look at lifelong learning. One of the most important functions of our schools is to develop and nurture in our children a love of lifelong learning. If you compare football, for example, versus music, 99% of the kids, the last football game they play is the last time they'll ever play football. But music, you can play it till your last days. So in terms of lifelong learning, it's so much more effective. Just the mere fact that half of the student population, meaning girls, can't play football, for example, but everyone can play music. Music is math. Music is reading. Music is logic. Music is language, and the data backs all that up. Every single day, it seems there's a new study coming out about how music program, vibrant music programs enhances these academic skills and interpersonal skills. And the other thing is, you know, you talk about one of the major justifications for sports in our schools is that it teaches this concept of building character, teamwork, discipline, communication skills, personal responsibility. Well, you know, and it's true, but I've been on a five-person basketball team when and trying to and being required to develop those types of skills, communication skills, discipline, teamwork, all those kind of things, in pursuit of a common goal, which is winning. Okay, but I've also been in a five-person band, trying to work together to achieve a common sound, and it's the exact same things. Discipline, teamwork, communication skills, personal responsibility. So if you really take a close, honest look at the data, the return on educational dollars invested in music is tremendous. A lot of people talk about, is music a core course? Or is it core? Is it co-curricular? Is it extracurricular? I kind of view it differently. Because of the universal nature of music, it's a universal language. I think music is more like the glue that can hold the entire core curriculum together. Because you can use music and apply it and use it to teach science lessons, history lessons. Music is math, all of those things. So the value of music as an educational tool is just astounding. And the data coming out every single day reinforces that point.
Most educators... Maybe I shouldn't say most. I won't make a judgment there. But I would say many educators would agree with you, what you just said. But yet, if they said, all right, we're going to cut, we have a tight budget here, and we have to cut some extracurricular activities. If they said we were going to cut the football program or in some way cut back on that compared to the music program and not cut any funding from the music program, they would have people up in arms.
Yes, they would, and that's something that I think as
by the way, I'm not saying that's right. I'm just saying, observation.
No, first of all, the football or athletics lobby, for lack of a better term, is very well organized, very vocal. The music and arts community isn't quite as effective in its advocacy, but I do think a lot of that is changing, particularly on the football side, driven by the revelations about head trauma.
Right.
I think we're slowly changing. But again, we simply, educational leaders and community leaders, we simply cannot continue to fund programs simply because we've always done it that way. The world is changing too rapidly. We have to look at the data, look at the research, and ask an honest question, what is more effective in terms of educational return on investment, because we're operating the expectations of our schools and our teachers to instill in our children an education worthy of the 21st century are rising dramatically at the same time in an environment of declining resources. So that begs the question, we have to be more effective and efficient with every single educational dollar we spend. And if you're honest about looking at it, take an honest look at it, the data is just irrefutable about how effective music is.
Let's bring Lisa Semsi into our conversation. She's a music teacher and K through 12 art and music curriculum coordinator at the Columbia Borough School District. Ms. Semsi, you have to be happy to hear what Dr. Gurdy had to say about the benefits of music education. But what's been your experience in the Columbia School District as far as funding goes, as far as participation goes, and how do the people in positions of power, administrators, how do they view music?
So in Columbia, we're really fortunate. First of all, it's an arts-oriented town. If you walk down the streets of Columbia, you're going to find art galleries and artisans creating things as you just look at our storefront. So the town itself is an arts-oriented town. However, it also is one of the smallest school districts in the state of Pennsylvania. And so taxation on the community and the funding that we get at the state and federal levels are exactly how education happens in any school district. But in our school district, it's unique because we're somewhere around 2.5 miles square in our whole school district. So it becomes that every penny counts. Our administrative team made a commitment a long time ago to want to keep our program strong. As the budget crisis happened, you know, a few governors ago, and the way that the funding came through the state system into Columbia, there were some very difficult decisions to be made, and the administrative team had some heart-wrenching tasks. And across the board, there were some downsizing that happened in our community, and some of it did land in the music department. Only one position, it went to part-time. It was the fourth through sixth grade band position, and it was very difficult on the administrative team to make that happen. However, in the meantime, Music for Everyone was a very much up-and-coming organization in our county and doing a lot of good work throughout the county. And so, through the grant processes and then also some proposals to Music for Everyone, we could supplement what was going on in our school district's budget. For instance, we had some instruments that were granted to my program personally, which is in the K-6 general music program, and also at the 4th through 12th grade band program, as well as the general music and vocal program, 7th through 12th grade. That funding in itself created stability at a time where the budget was very stretched thin, and the administrative team had to make some very difficult decisions. Throughout the time, though, the administrative team, if I went to them personally, of which I do, we have very open communication, whether it's our principals or our director of curriculum and instruction or our superintendent, and need to have some candid conversations. They always have open ears and open hearts, and then we look at how does this positively affect our students, and that's always been the main focus in Columbia. So how does it positively affect our community? We got to work in partnership with John and his staff and fund and supplement instruments. We've had Music for Everyone scholars who have come in. Not only are they learning, they're students at a local university who are sort of in an internship process. Not only are they learning, but they help work with smaller groups within a larger context, and some music mentors. And those mentors are meant to supplement in some areas that maybe the district couldn't fund, like in our program a few years ago that had to do with our 7th through 12th grade band program and providing small group lessons and what we call sectionals at that level.
Hey, Miss Sempsey, I'm going to interrupt you because I know you got to get to class.
I do in a minute or two. My kids are waiting, but I moved some things around so I could talk to you.
Okay. Lisa Sempsey is a music teacher in Columbia School District. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Yeah. Just Music for Everyone's great in our community, and I couldn't say more positive things in the way they work with our school district.
Thank you. You have to be happy to hear that, John. But, you know, let me get back to, I mean, we were kind of talking the broad picture about music and athletics, extracurricular activities, but we didn't talk specifically about what Music for Everyone does.
Right. Our mission is to cultivate the power of music as an educational and community-building tool in Lancaster County. And what we do basically is we go to schools, we ask them where the gaps are, what their needs are, and then we turn around to the community and we say, hey, does any of this interest you? If so, invest in us. And then we will turn around and strategically, effectively, and efficiently invest those resources in schools and community arts groups throughout the county. To date, we've been around for 12 years, and we've invested, I think we're closing in on close to, I guess, $1.7 million in total investment. Everything from an annual instrument grant program. Last year, for example, we awarded over $112,000 in grants for instruments. We give to all 16 school districts in the county. But the thing about it is that the gap still exists because we received about $250,000 in requests. But if you provide instruments, then you can provide a class of 30 kids or an orchestra of 30 kids, everyone a brand new instrument. If there's only one instructor, what's the point? So then next we're underwriting music mentors, professional musicians, music education majors. So that was the instruction component. And we've just announced, so about 2 weeks ago or so, 3 weeks ago, our third component, the third leg of the stool, is a program, instrument repair program, where we are going to catalog and repair every single instrument of every single public school in Lancaster County on an ongoing basis.
Wow.
So that's our next big thing, and we've secured some seed grant money from the Steinman Foundation and Clark Industries to get that up and going. But for example, we did a pilot program at Columbia last summer where we repaired 50 some odd instruments, something like that. So yeah, you got to take care of them if you're going to give them away, because there's no room in the budget for repairs for schools.
What about student participation? I mean, you're in a position to see, okay, maybe there have been some schools that have cut back on their music programs, but are there fewer students, the same, more, that actually want to participate in music programs?
We believe that if you build it, they will come.
Uh-huh.
One of the best things I've heard from a teacher just recently was talking about how their string program, it was in the school district of Lancaster, was expanding, more kids being involved, because when you pay attention to them, you give them instruments, you give them instruction, you make them feel important, it suddenly becomes cool. So she said, you know, the kids are starting to think, hey, man, it's cool to be a part of the music program. So the other cool thing about now that we're around for 12 years, things are really starting to become full circle. For example, there's a young man in our program who's been a part of our MFE Strings, which is an after-school program, and our summer camps since fourth grade. Just graduated McCaskey High School, and now he's coming back to serve as a mentor for the younger kids. So a lot of it's starting to come full circle now. But again, I think if you build it, they will come. If as a community or a school board, what you fund, what you prioritize, has an impact. In other words, if you say it's important and then you fund it accordingly so that people see evidence, oh, this is important, then the community will follow. And so that's what we plan to continue to do with music education.
You know, Lisa Sempsey said something that struck me. She was talking about Columbia. She said, we are an artsy town, that art is important. Mm-hmm. The city of Lancaster, let's face it, the city of Lancaster in the last 10 to 15 years has become an arts destination.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That would seem to say the message that is passed on to young people is the arts, including music, is important in this city.
Absolutely. And you know, you talked about why sometimes the arts community is not as effective as it needs to be as an advocacy. One of the reasons is because we've just used the argument when fighting for funding, when fighting for, you know, for priorities in the school budget, arts for art's sake. And yes, arts for art's sake is important. It feeds the soul. It does all of those great things. But we've also got to talk about the practical impacts. Impact on test scores, impact on reading skills, impact on kids wanting to be more engaged in school, and also the economic impact of music and the arts in our communities. So the argument needs to be more, it's not just arts for art's sake, that's this, you know, fluffy thing to do. It's important because it's driving our economy in a lot of ways, and Lancaster is a tremendous example about that, about strategically investing in the arts to build a community for economic vitality, and we've been very successful at doing that.
You've been successful in doing it, but I kind of go back to that, what we had discussed earlier, that getting society as a whole to understand how important this is. How do you do that?
You pound away day in and day out, but again, it's data. The data is out there for it. If you look at the data in terms of music's educational impact on all of this wide area, for example, when we went to school, the idea of international learning opportunities, exchange programs, tours, and stuff like that were non-existent, right? But in today's interconnected global economy and world community, our schools are expected to provide some sort of international flavor, international opportunities. Music is a tremendous platform to do that because it's the international language, or the universal language.
We only have a minute or so to go, mm-hmm. and I want to thank you very much for being with us, but I do have a quick question from a listener who says, has several musical instruments from his father's estate. Do you know where he can donate them for this cause?
Well, we could contact us and we could help you. musicforeveryone.org.
Okay. What are you looking at? I mean, in 30 seconds, less, what kind of message would you like to leave with our guests? What do you need?
Anything and everything. I mean, we are every day out there scrapping and trying to generate resources and then turn around, whether it's volunteers, whether it's cash, whether it's instruments, whether it's... To then turn around and invest them strategically to enhance our music programs in our communities.
John Gurdy is founder and executive of Music for Everyone in Lancaster County. But, you know, this is something that can spread beyond the Lancaster County borders, I'm sure. John, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, we talk about climate change, cap and trade through the courts here in Pennsylvania. That's coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk. Also, we learn about a series of stories written about nursing homes here in Pennsylvania. That's on tomorrow's show.